Founded in 1932, Lego brand toys and building blocks are a cornerstone of many people's childhoods. Even adults revel in the joy and creativity that Legos bring.
But despite building their company on strong foundations, in 2003, this long-standing Danish company was millions of dollars in debt and on the brink of crumbling, selling their product for less than it cost to produce.
So, how did this once popular company get so far in debt? And how did they go from selling product for below cost to rebuilding into the world's second largest toy company?
Let's connect the bricks and find out. This is Lego on the Brink.
So today, obviously, we are talking about Lego, which is famous for the building block toys, although that's not how the company got started.
You're right. It got started in 1932 by Ole Kirk Christiansen, who was a master carpenter. So he was already doing carpentry work.
Yeah.
And then when his carpentry things kind of fell out of demand because of the Great Depression, he decided to use the wood that he had left to make toys.
He enlisted the help of his son, Gottfried, who would become very important to the Lego company.
Yes.
And he chose the name Lego for his company, which was inspired by Danish words leg and godt, which were to play well.
Yeah. And despite, you know, what you might deduce, ego does not mean to eat well.
No. Also, he did not realize this at the time, but the Latin phrase, I put together, is essentially Lego.
Yes.
And you might think, oh, how very clever. Not only was it a Danish phrase, it was a Latin phrase. Well, that second part was just
happenstance.
Yeah.
But I will say, when he first started making toys, he actually hit bankruptcy and his family was telling him to stop. Just stop, figure out something else to do, you know, get a bailout loan. And he said no. And eventually his company started to take off. He was really good at making toys.
Mm-hmm. And in the 40s, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men do have to go aglay, as we understand it.
The factory burned to the ground and it destroyed their wooden toys and it destroyed their plans for new toys. But, you know, thankfully, people liked what they were making, so they were able to turn it around and keep producing.
They had made enough money through the toy production that they were able to have a recovery effort, which is, I mean, this could have been the brink right here. The idea of you make wooden toys and your
you
factory caught
fire.
Yeah, that would normally be, and this is why the company no longer exists.
Yes.
But because they were able to rebuild, the story does not end there.
Yeah, something else they were fiddling with in the 40s was plastic injection molding.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of a cheaper way to produce toys. And they kind of figured it out, but they weren't allowed to use it until the end of the 40s because of material shortages. The Danish government said no plastic injection molding right now.
Right. It was a similar issue that you saw during the war in various countries where certain materials were earmarked for war effort. And in the post-war, especially post-war Europe, there were certain materials that were very scarce. And so once that restriction lifted, they could actually use this plastic injection molding machine to start producing plastic parts. They made like little plastic balls and stuff early on. The machine cost 30,000 Danish krona. And to give you an idea of how much that was in relation to the company's value, around that same time, they had a revenue of 450,000 krona. So 30,000 krona, that represented a significant investment. You know, it's not quite 10% of the value of the company, but still, that's a big investment.
It is, you know, but it did pay off. Now, along with making little plastic balls and stuff, they also made Tiddlywinks.
Yep.
They had a traffic board game called Monopoly.
Yeah.
Not Monopoly.
Not Monopoly. It's M-O-N-Y-P-O-L-I.
Yes. And they made their first Lego automatic binding brick.
And it just rolls off the tongue.
Yes. In a 4 and 8 stud version in 4 different colors. This was in 1949. But they didn't actually completely come up with the idea. They had borrowed the design from Kittycraft with their permission.
Yeah. No, this wasn't like they ended up stealing someone else's design.
No.
They actually licensed it.
And in fact, in 1981, they bought the rights to the Kittycraft bricks. So
I think this is really interesting that Lego, the company, had existed for a couple of decades, before making the product that we all associate with Lego.
Yeah.
Like I don't even, I mostly hear people refer to Lego bricks just as Legos, mm-hmm. right? That, so you don't even think of other things that the company has gotten involved in.
No. And in fact, other snap together bricks, like knockoffs, are also called Legos.
Yeah. To the point, and you have this in our notes, it's almost getting to that stage where it's hard to protect the trademark, because if enough people use it to refer to a general line of products and you haven't been able to protect your trademark adequately, then people can just use it for anything. We see that with Kleenex and Xerox and Jell-O. You know,
and Lego did have some issues, some lawsuits, but we'll get to that. By the end of the 1940s, they had almost 50 employees, and the blocks were just doing okay at that time.
Yeah, they didn't exactly just immediately take off and become the iconic toy.
It's true. But they also, in the 50s, perfected the Lego's coupling system.
Yes.
And they patented it.
Yeah, this is where you get those tubes on the inside of the bricks where they snap together. And they also had this philosophy with their bricks, because they had all these different shapes and sizes that they could make. But they recognized that there was a real value if you could make sure that they were all compatible with each other. And that became a foundational part of their design process. They actually called it the Lego system of play. And the central idea of that was, if you make a new Lego piece, it should be compatible with all the existing Lego pieces.
And they've kind of veered away and veered back to that over the years, but it's still basically the foundation of their idea today.
Yeah, the idea being you think about the way kids play, right? So you've got the way you're meant to do something, quote unquote, but kids, they think outside the box all the time, unless they're playing in a box, which is usually
but
what happens on Christmas.
Still thinking outside the box, in the box, so, under a box, with a box.
Yeah, there's a whole Dr. Seussian kind of thing going on. But the idea being that you don't want to limit kids' creativity, so that way if they have four different Lego playsets and each playset is meant to be a specific type of thing, don't punish them for experimenting and mixing things up and making a mishmash, because that's where you see some real creativity. So by the end of the 1950s, they had really started to invest in automation as well. And they got to a point where they had brick-making machines where one operator could handle two machines at the same time. And I just like to think of some Danish person standing between two massive machines, just a lever in each hand, and, you know, alternating, pulling down on one while the other one's moving up. And just
kind of like a little boogie.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe there's some ABBA playing in the background.
Yes.
Although that's not Danish.
No.
It's close.
Anyhow, in the early 60s, they stopped making wooden toys.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had another fire that destroyed them all. Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me, Jonathan.
No, I was just thinking, like, why would you stop making wooden toys? Well, gosh darn it, these things sure are flammable.
Yeah. And they were up to 450 employees.
And they opened up their first amusement park called
Legoland.
Yeah. And the first year that it existed, they had 625,000 visitors. Mm-hmm. So not too shabby. On the first day, there were 3,000 people who showed up. They were all put to work to build the park out of little bricks.
I believe it. They also created Duplo bricks, which are, you know, the nice big bricks so babies don't choke on them.
Yeah, for the little kids.
Yes. And they made their first Lego wheel, which also got its own patent.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up signing a licensing agreement with Samsonite. And they started to create their little Lego minifigs, the little figurines that you would get with different playsets. So without those, there'd be no Lego movie. There'd be none of the Lego games.
I mean, you know.
The video games, that is.
By the time I was born, we had little Lego people. Didn't stop me from building Lego people.
Sure, yeah. You could have made little blocky Lego people.
Yeah, and they also started doing things like making castle sets and astronaut sets. And then Kjeld
Kjeld Christensen
took over the company.
Yeah.
Who is Ole's grandson.
Yes, so still keeping it in the family. And by the 1980s, we started seeing surveys that showed that Lego had reached an incredible saturation in the European market, that Western European families that happened to have children who were 14 or younger, 80% of them owned Lego.
Yeah.
Like a Lego set or just random Legos or whatever.
I mean, like, technically, technically, you could pick up a Lego on the street and say, hey, I own Legos.
Yeah, but that probably didn't.
No, that probably didn't factor into it. Also, they started cross promotions with McDonald's, and then a lot of their patent expired and a lot of knockoffs emerged, like Tyco.
Yeah, so now they suddenly had a lot more competition, including competition from less expensive sets that started coming out. That would continue to be a problem, especially with competitors that were emerging out of Asia, specifically China, where the manufacturing process could be incredibly cheap. And Lego was still doing quite well on its own, but there was this rising kind of concern that there were some competitors just looming, getting ready to pounce.
And they did try to combat the competitors. They did file lawsuits in several countries for patent infringement, but they weren't all successful.
And by the 90s, they were in the top 10 for largest toy manufacturers. They were doing really well with some licensing agreements. I like that you have here that they got a record in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yes, they built a track, 545 meters of track, with three separate locomotive trains on it.
Goodness.
Yeah.
There was also a period of chaos a bit where they had to do a recall because some of those little pieces were a little too little.
And yes.
They were deemed a choking hazard.
They also started a partnership with Star Wars. They actually checked with their consumer base first to make sure that it wasn't too violent because it has the name Wars.
Lego, for a very long time, tried to make sure it was not associated with any sort of violence.
Yeah, they didn't even want to make any sort of modern-day weapons in their Lego figures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But while this was all going on, their parks weren't really growing yet. They were doing okay, but they weren't growing in attendance. And while they had weathered several storms and two major fires, the really big, big challenge was just around the corner, and we'll talk about it in just a moment. But first, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor. All right, so Ariel, things seem to be going more or less pretty well for Lego. They were really on an incredible trajectory. They were getting into lots of different areas. What exactly was the tipping point? What was the problem that ended up really shaking the company?
Okay, so in the mid to late 90s, they found out they were having a declining interest in construction play. Kids were losing interest in traditional toys for more technologically advanced toys. And they were failing at something called differentiation, according to the brand asset valuator test, which was done by an advertising agency, Young and Rubikin.
Mm-hmm.
When you're failing at differentiation as a company, it usually means you're failing as a brand. It means that you haven't expanded your product line enough to appeal to the number of people you need to appeal to make your profits.
And it may mean that you are not diversifying in a way that is identifiable to your brand.
Yes.
Right? So let's say that you are known for making action figures and you make a line of action figures that are fairly popular. And then you think, all right, we're going to make a totally different line. It's not related to the action figures, but we're going to make a totally different line of toy vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things, they're fairly related. You could see where there could be some brand recognition. But if you went from action figures to
like hula hoops
or aquariums or something that doesn't seem to be as connected, then it's harder to make that connection where the customer has an idea of what your company is about. If you make tons of different, apparently disparate and disconnected things, no one knows what you're about other than they make stuff.
Yeah. Well, Lego found out that they weren't diversifying enough. And so they said, we want to be more than just bricks. We want to go from this building model to a just imagine creativity model. And they tried to add lifestyle elements like clothes and watches and TV shows. And it just wasn't really hitting.
Yeah. They weren't seeing a reflection in the sales that would show that this was a working strategy. So they decided to retire some of their employees that they referred to as designers, and they decided to hire on a bunch of younger folks that they called
innovators. And this was a part of their diversifying strategy. They wanted to get a lot of different things out at once very quickly.
And one of the things they also did was they said, well, you know what? Let's add so much more variety. We're going to change up how many different types of Lego you can get. And they went from having 6,000 different pieces, which is already blowing my mind that there were 6,000 different types of Lego, and they doubled that to 12,000.
But the problem is that they weren't 6,000 more pieces that could just play with any piece in your set.
Yeah.
They were 6,000 pieces that were made specifically for very specific playsets, so like a Star Wars speeder.
Or an Ewok village.
Yes, or something like that.
And so that whole sort of manifesto that they had created years earlier, where they had defined their philosophy, seemed to be out the window.
Yeah, they were no longer sticking to their system of play structure.
Mm-hmm. And then they were also looking at integrating with other brands beyond things like Star Wars. Star Wars had been a real success, but then they started really hitting that super hard. And you see this today, too, again, with like all the Lego video games and the Lego movie. You see a lot of incorporation of different intellectual property within those things. This is kind of where that all got started.
Yes, but when they started, they didn't know how to do this. So they had really high licensing fees. Because they had all these specialized sets, they had really high production costs because they had to, you know, use specific machines to get specific pieces that were not necessarily the same molds they were using for everything else.
Right, right. They couldn't just use, like, oh, turn the switch to Batman. It wasn't like that. So anytime they had to make a specialized piece, it would require new processes because they couldn't just make it out of the regular bricks. So they started having issues with that. I mean, you start seeing rising costs of production. We mentioned early in the episode about how they would start selling products for less money than it costs to actually make them. One of the crazy, crazy things is at this stage, they didn't know how much some of these playsets were costing them.
No, they were basically anybody who had an idea that they thought was good. They're like, cool, let's make it. Without really researching the costs or the time.
Yeah.
They didn't put a lot of specific processes together for their production.
So they have this enormous, enormous inventory, enormous variety of pieces, all these different playsets, all these different branded playsets with various licensed characters, some of those licenses costing thousands and thousands of dollars just to be able to use them. All these things going on. They find out that 30 of their products are responsible for 80% of their revenue.
Yeah, and that's got to be tough.
Yeah, no, when you sit there and say, like, you have thousands of products and 30 of them make up 80% of your revenue, then the natural thing to ask is, why the heck are we making everything else if you consider the expense of making everything else? And then you compare that to how much money it's bringing in. And you say there's no justification there. Mm-hmm. So that was another huge wake-up call.
The bigger wake-up call is that they hit a huge financial deficit and loss between 2000 and 2004, specifically in 2003 and 2004, despite the fact that in 2000 they were named the toy of the century.
Yeah. So in 2000, they had a loss of $104 million. That's a huge chunk of change. And they also had to do reorganizations and restructuring. And this is before they were even able to address the actual problems. This was them saying, we have to cut costs. And when we say cut costs, we usually mean layoffs.
Yeah. So they laid off 2,000 employees in 2001. And that wasn't enough because in 2003, their sales dropped by 30%.
Ugh.
Resulting in a $300 million loss.
So yeah, that $104 million was bad, but it was just a hint of what was to come.
And it was $400 million by the following year.
Ugh. So this was a point where it was getting so desperate that there were rumors that some of the executives over at Lego were even putting feelers out to see if possibly there might be a buyer to acquire the company, including the big target was Mattel. But that didn't happen. We did, however, have Lego right there on the verge, the brink, as we say. And they were ready to fall apart. But what would save them from turning into rubble and guarantee that for generations, parents would know the joy of walking barefoot on a Lego brick in the middle of the night?
Well, we'll tell you after this brief word from our sponsors.
Okay, so Lego's grown dramatically. Lego has perhaps reached beyond its grasp. It has suffered massive losses. It has found that there is a huge void where a strong infrastructure needs to be.
They're dangerously close to becoming Icarus.
What do they do? What do they do to turn things around?
Well, in 2004, they put a plan into motion to repair their brand damage they had caused trying to over-diversify. Mm-hmm. This process had an estimated 7-year span.
They hire a guy named Jorgen Vig Nudstorp, but he became the first CEO of the company who was not related to Ole Christensen, the founder of the company way back in the early 20th century. And so he was the first, quote unquote, outside CEO of Lego. And he would still work with Christensen, the grandson.
Yes.
To kind of put things together. They set up a war room.
With lots of various senior executives.
Mm-hmm. And they decided that they were going to figure out how to fix the company, no matter how dramatic the reorganization was going to have to be.
Yeah, and they realized that one of the big things they needed to do was go back to their core concept, to go back, quote unquote, to the brick. So they reorganized and consolidated their company. They fixed their outsourcing issues.
Which meant that they were picking cheaper places to manufacture.
Yes. And they made sure to continue to let all their staff give them ideas of new products. But they made sure that those products, if they produced them, fit within their company goal.
And that they made sure that they had a good grasp on how much it was actually going to cost
yes.
to make and how much they should charge for the product once it was going to hit store shelves. They created a new inventory system so they could keep track of stuff and not end up producing more pieces than they needed at any given time. They really were focusing on addressing that mess of an infrastructure mm-hmm. that they had had.
Yeah, they fixed their supply chain issues. So they analyzed the materials they needed and the prices and put together pilot programs and then narrowed their chain of contracted suppliers, which allowed them to get better pricing and do planning for all of their production. They reduced the amount of colors they had and the number of unique pieces back from 12,000 to 7,000.
So still a little more than what they were at when they did that dramatic doubling, but significantly fewer pieces than what they had been doing. So also creating less of a strain on the manufacturing system because they were making fewer of those unique pieces. And so all of this obviously took a lot of time. That's why they said this is going to be like a 7-year mm-hmm. plan. But while this was going, they were starting to see results fairly quickly. Like they were starting to see that these efforts were already paying off. They continued to work on fixing things by selling off some of the divisions that they had under their umbrella when they were trying to diversify,
mm-hmm.
but hadn't really been a huge success. So they sold off things like their computer game division. They would still work with licensing and everything, but mm-hmm. they weren't developing them in-house.
Yeah, so with Legoland and with the computer games, other companies run them.
Yeah.
And they're just partnered with it.
And they also started to get a better feel for when they should release licensed properties. Because one of the problems they were running into is that they would release play sets that were connected to licensed characters, but they wouldn't time it with important events that were involving those characters. So, for example, if you have a new Marvel movie coming out, that's when it makes sense to release a superhero set.
Yes.
In other words, they're improving efficiencies, they're cutting their costs, they're putting in the systems that should have been there already.
Yes.
And by 2005, which was early on in this whole process, you know, that they were planning, they were already starting to see some reversals of fortune. The company was starting to edge toward profitability again.
And they continued to edge towards that profitability the following year as well. And they started doing things like pushing retro Legos. Because retro is totally a thing.
Yeah, retro is totally hot.
Yeah. And, you know, tools that enabled more creativity and relaunching their classic lines like Lego Duplo or their city sets to balance out all of these theme things like Star Wars. But they did make sure that as they're balancing out their more creative play with their more theme sets, that they would interact together.
Yes, so that you wouldn't have these special pieces that could only work one mm-hmm. way. Because as people were pointing out, they said, you know, some of the fun is really just this experimentation. Like part of the appeal is that there's endless possibility in the ways you could put these bricks together to make different stuff. And there's a good chance that you could make something that wasn't even remotely on the box, but is just as cool.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, like if I want to combine the Ghostbusters ghostbusting station with the Millennium Falcon.
I mean, there's nothing that should stop you from doing that.
No.
I think that sort of thing is really cool. They also got into really focusing on how to work with media companies. This is why we got the Lego movie. And they also realized the popularity of retro blocks and stuff like that reminded them that there's an entire generation of adults out there who have fond memories of Lego, apart from stepping on them with your bare feet, yeah. Where it's a part of their childhood, and some of them don't even have kids, but they still like to play with the Lego bricks.
I might be one of those people.
You might be one of those people.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but yeah.
No. Yeah, so they decided that they would also specifically target that audience, not just, you know, what if you find out that you have customers in a specific demographic, there are a couple things you could do. You could just say, oh, well, that's nice. Or you could say, well, what can we do to foster that relationship to make sure that we acknowledge that they're there and that we're thankful for them? And that's kind of the direction Lego went.
Yeah, they worked on viral marketing strategies and user-created content so that people who said, I've got this great idea for Lego, felt like they were listened to and it gave them extra investment in the toy. Mm-hmm. And they worked on community building with things like LegoFactory.com and their Lego Ambassador Program, which they're very picky about. Anybody can apply, but not anybody can become an ambassador. And then, like, they're LEGO certified professionals.
In 2012, they became the second largest toy company after Mattel. They bumped Hasbro down to third place. And they did have a bit of a slump in 2014, but that was largely due to an overall slump in the market, not specifically LEGO's performance, but an overall market effect. And they've continued pushing forward with this plan and this new approach since they had this rebranding effort, and it's done pretty well for them. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Brink. It's about time for Ariel and I to go and hit the bricks.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys stay tuned. We're going to be covering lots more companies and entrepreneurs who met with that big moment of where things could have gone one way or the other, and why did it turn out the way it did? And we look forward to talking to you soon. Until then, I have been Jonathan Strickland.
And I have been Ariel Kasten. Bye-bye.
If you would like to learn more about what we've talked about, as well as keep track of all of our episodes, make sure you visit our website at thebrinkpodcast.show.
Or you can email us at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show. We'll be right back.